But this time, he comes back saying, "You've got to go over there. This is bigger than all of us." 6. In 1967, Lee Elders had gone to work for Capital Detective Agency in Phoenix, a job that allowed him to work his own hours and afforded him several months off each year to travel, explore, and eventually lead expeditions into the Amazon basin, primarily the El Oriente region of Ecuador. Born in Bowie, Arizona, Elders had been reared in the desert, a place of hard edges and little subtlety. The landscape had shaped his personality. He walked with a determined forward lean, shoulders hunched, lost in thought, caring little for diplomacy. Britt Nielsen had met him at the Phoenix airport in 1974, as he returned from an expedition, banging his way through customs carrying an armload of blowguns and spears. He hadn't bathed in 2 weeks. "I wish you could have met Lee back when I met him," she said later. "I couldn't stand him. He was the most horrible, arrogant, you know what. He was obnoxious," is the best word to describe Lee. "And he thought he was perfect." Britt, calm and well-reasoned, is a tall, buxom woman with large brown eyes from the Indian side of her heritage and blonde hair from her Scandinavian ancestors. She recently had divorced. Though she was 15 years younger, Lee eventually won her over, and she agreed to marry him. Years of exploration in South America had etched deep fissures into Elder's face. A friend who had known him in South America in 1974, back when Ecuador represented the equivalent of an Egypt in the early 1900s, claimed that Elders was the first non-native to enter vast regions of the Amazon basin and forge relationships with the territorial Jivaros and Shuaras. Estimates at the time were that no more than 1 in every 10 artifacts surviving the Spanish conquest of the Inca civilization had been recovered. During the early 1970s, based on 400-year-old legend and recent tribal rumor, Elders had arranged the financing and equipment for archaeological expeditions into the jungle in search of the Inca Huaca. Back in the States, working again for the Capital Agency in early 1976, Lee Elders, then 38, had been assigned to a large transportation company to find, screen, and qualify 10 individuals the company could place within its employee ranks to penetrate a theft ring. One afternoon, while Elders talked to the company's head of security about the theft problem, a phone call interrupted their conversation. Elders overheard the security man say, "What do you mean you lost it? Sensitive company data sent from one computer in one building to another computer across the street somehow had never made it to the second computer." The security man hung up the phone and said to Elders, "Holy Christ! How could this happen?" Elders explained to him that the information could have been intercepted. Tom Welch, a close friend of Elders, worked for the same detective agency. That evening, Elders told Welch about the conversation he had had with the security guard, and Welch began searching for a countermeasure firm. Through he turned up several other private investigation companies like Capital, none of them specialized in telecommunications. He expanded his search beyond Phoenix to include the entire Southwest and still found no one capable of investigating computer theft. "Tom and I started talking," Elders said later. "There's a tremendous need out here for a company that could protect against this. Maybe we should start one." Then, we started researching it and found out there's a lot of theft going on. Then, after another 6 months of searching, we stumbled on a company in New York that had state-of-the-art telephone analyzers which you could hook up online and do your sweeps with. With this level of sophistication, in less than an hour, they could probe a huge communications system and determine the use of every wire out of thousands in the system. We're not talking about something like black boxes and wands," said Welch. "We're not talking about little RF bugs, we're talking about manipulating the wiring. That's where sophisticated data theft takes place. They can run it right in front of everybody's nose, out of the building and anywhere in the city, and in some cases across the country." In the latter part of 1976, Tom Welch and Lee and Britt Elders purchased the $20,000 telephone analyzer and founded Intercept, A company of licensed investigators trained in the protection of corporate security. Corporate officers suspicious of sensitive information leaks quietly hired interceptor discovered the source of the leaks, either in the ranks of their employees or as taps within their telecommunications system. With most of their work consisting of non-crisis security checks, Intercept specialized in preventing computer theft and the bugging of executive phones and offices by competitors. After a year and a half, they had performed for three of the top 10 Fortune 500 corporations, and business already had expanded overseas. When Dell Stevens returned from Switzerland, he realized he had become involved in a case potentially so big he would be incapable of investigating it. There were landing tracks he could not explain, witnesses who needed further interrogation, scores of photographs he did not know how to analyze definitively. "I was convinced there was so much here," said Stevens, "that no UFO club could ever investigate it properly. It would take several people, well equipped, trained in proper investigative techniques. I'd spin my wheels forever trying to find out what they could turn up in today's." The elders had already seen some of the mirror photos the Deluzinstag laid them out carefully on Stephen's dining room table. The photos had impressed them at first, but Lee Elders was certain they were fake and mirror and the witnesses crazy. "I came back," recalled Stevens, "and told Lee I didn't think they were a bunch of cooks. As a cross-section of people, they probably were more intellectual than we were and as smart as any of us, probably smarter than most of our UFO researchers." "Well then," said Elders, "they ought to be able to find out what's going on. The man himself is not smart enough to fool all of those people," said Stevens. "I sat down across from him and looked him in the eye. He's a simple man, he's very sincere, he doesn't have much of an education, he doesn't have any resources, he doesn't have anything going for him. Plus, a lot of people are watching him, and I couldn't find anybody who had seen anything suspicious." "Bullshit," countered Elders, "they're pulling your leg over there." Stevens listed four reasons the Mir case appeared unique among many thousands of UFO cases. 1, he said, "there are more notes and more information, and more detailed descriptions of events provided by witnesses, than in any other UFO case recorded. 2, there are more photographs and many of the photographs are better than in any other UFO case ever. 3, there is more physical evidence to study and analyze in this case than in any other UFO case known. And 4, there are more individual contact events in this case than any other in history, and the contact is still going on." During less reserved moments, Stevens called the Mir story the hands-down greatest UFO case of all time, and the biggest, most spectacular, longest-running, most productive case in the history of the phenomenon. But the elders were not interested. Not only was Lee Elders busy, but he was also concerned about the reputation of his fast-growing security firm. "I'm just getting big into Intercept," he said, "and this wild colonel, who's just lost all objectivity after 30 years, gets me out chasing UFOs. My career's right down the toilet. What if the story's real?" Stevens asked him. "It can't hurt it then." "But you don't have any proof that it's real," replied Elders. "That's what I'm trying to find out," said Stevens. "I wouldn't worry about the case," Elders told him. "It's all a bunch of baloney anyway." "No, it's not," argued Stevens. "Something's going on there. It's changed to many people's lives." "Steve," said Lee, "we just can't get involved in stuff like that." Britt Elders kept a diary. Every evening she recorded the highlights of daily occurrences and conversations with friends. On November 19, 1977, she wrote the following entry: "Steve arrived Phoenix PM blown away. Mir for real. 3 hours of ranting and raving. Lee not paying much attention. Never seen Steve so up. Can't interest Lee. Who has time to chase UFOs? Didn't phase, sick, Steve, kept rambling. Pushed for Lee to throw Intercept into investigation. Lee and I talked rest of night. He doesn't want to commit the company name to such a weird subject. Steve will have to understand." Stevens resorted to pleading. He said, Look, I've got a problem. I can go to the UFO organizations with this, they all would jump at the chance to get control of it. But they'll investigate it with mail order investigators, and they'll surely fuck it up like they do all of the others. I need some real investigation on this. I need people who know how to look for information, I need somebody who's got staying power, I need somebody who isn't going to waste time, who knows what to do and how to document it. One of Stephen's main concerns was the rate at which some of the photographs were disappearing. Whether the story of the contacts was true or not, the evidence might be gone before anyone had a chance to analyze it. As Intercept grew over the next few months, and the Elders and Welch became more involved in the business, Stevens continued his pleas. Once they met Mia, walked some of the sites, and talked to the witnesses, he felt certain they would agree with him that something was going on. Elders and Welch humored, even teased him about his sudden devotion to this one case. But they knew Stevens well enough to realize something must be different about the Mia story. Though for 30 years Stevens had maintained that UFOs were of extraterrestrial origin and he had a mind open to even the most outlandish of stories, he did require proof, and until he saw that proof, he gave no credence to unsupported claims. The photographs were proof, but only if they held up, and despite their looking almost too good to be valid, Stevens has found nothing during his trip that would indicate they somehow had been fabricated. Though none of them would admit it at the time, the Elders and Welch had their curiosities piqued ever so slightly by Stephen's failure to uncover Mia's technique. He had unveiled so many in the past, often by simply studying a photo in his hand. It wasn't just a tall tale, Welch said later. Either there was one hell of an intriguing story, how somebody did all of this and pulled it off under the guise of being a naive Swiss farmer, or there might be, for the first time, an incredibly historic event. See, in April 1978, the Elders had to travel to London on business. When Stevens heard about the trip, he immediately suggested it was a perfect opportunity. After they had concluded work for their client, he could meet them in London and the three of them could then take the night train to Zurich. It wouldn't cost much. Then, they could rent a car and drive through the Swiss countryside. They would love Switzerland in the spring. And spend a couple of days in a quaint guest house. Meeting Mia and talking to some of the people at the farm might even change their minds. The Elders had never been to Switzerland, and the client was to pick up the tab for the flight to London. A few days on a side trip with Stevens, who typically investigated his cases carrying a small backpack filled with notebooks and apples, would be inexpensive. The Elders finally decided that if it meant that much to Stevens to have them just look at the farm and talk for a while with Mia, they could afford the time. I don't think I convinced Lee by telling him what I saw, said Stevens. What convinced him, I think, more than anything else was my appeal as a friend to come help me take a look because there was nobody else I could rely on to do it. He said, "We'll come over there, but we're not coming over to investigate any of your cookie stuff." With the Elders scheduled to be in London the 1st of April, Tom Welch remained in Phoenix for the Honeywell Corporation's 4th National Computer Security and Privacy Symposium. The two-day affair promised the latest information by many of the nation's most prominent authorities on the subject of system security and privacy. Honeywell had asked Tom Welch to give the featured address on electronics communications protection. Since we were trying to learn and constantly develop our abilities in our business, recalled Welch, it required us to be at the frontier edge of computers and electronics and communications. By then, we had had a ton of experience in a number of small cases, and we were picking up major clients. Some of our cases involved rather elaborate cover stories, new employees as well as an electronic penetration, industrial espionage, a variety of things. And it was here that we were developing a knack for bursting the bubble. Their growing knowledge and experience provided Welch with the material for his presentation. He assumed it also would serve the Elders well in Switzerland. There was a lot of potentially complicated detail involved with Mia, he said, and if it was a hoaxing effort, it was on a grand scale. But we were very confident that by the end of a week, if there was a hoax going on, Leon Britt would probably have gotten to the bottom of it. Our confidence stemmed from having this knack for penetrating the problems of our clients quickly. We had no expectation whatsoever of spending a lot of time on it. At the end of March, Stevens flew to London with the elders, and after a two-day sweep of the clients' offices, the three of them reserved berths on the night train from London to Zurich, and departed the evening of April 1. After renting a tiny bright orange Renault in Zurich, they drove northeast on the Autobahn to Winterthur, left the main highway, turned south, and continued through the countryside. The terrain was open and rolling, and speckled in the distance with three-story farmhouses under orange roofs, goats in the pen, and dairy cows with their heads bent into the green of the hillsides. Soon, they passed through Turbenthal, then Wieler, then took the unmarked turn off to Schmidruti, and began climbing into the hills, where great patches of snow still clung to the ground in areas shaded from the sun. The last series of tight switchbacks finally straightened and the road leveled out just as they reached the short cobblestone row that comprised Schmidruti. They swerved off the main road, past the Gasthaus Umfrilf, and headed down the dirt and gravel path, now overhung by grey leafless trees. When they arrived at the farm, they saw Mia outside washing his face in the horse trough. Since Stephen's first visit 6 months earlier, just before the snow and cold, little had changed around the farm. Spring rains and melting snow had turned the driveway back to mud, the roof still leaked, there was no plumbing, and the only heat came from a wood stove or the fireplace. To wash dishes, Popeye had to collect water from the cold pump and boil it on the stove. It was a disaster, Lee remembered. I mean, you talk about poverty, it was there. Britt recorded in her diary, first impression disaster area. Snow on the ground, bitter wind. Tiny white flowers coming through the snow. House looks like an old dilapidated barn, needs paint. Shutter on upstairs window hangs cockeyed. Big apple trees along hillside in front of house. Dirt, or rather mud. Road to house. Raining, pouring. Despite the wind and dampness, a small band of young people from various European countries had again migrated to the farm, the first of spring arrivals. Clustered in tents near the first barn, they were helping Mier dig trenches for a sewer line. Lee Elders had formed little opinion of Billy Mier, though he expected to dislike the man for having perpetrated a hoax and for having been responsible for a detour to Switzerland. Furthermore, if he was to begin snooping around, looking for evidence that Mia was a fraud, he had to consider Mia as his adversary, someone to be watched closely. But when he met the man, he found himself totally disarmed. Mia dried his hand and face, and walked over to where Stevens and the elders had pulled in with the car. Stevens introduced the elders as his friends from Phoenix. I met Mia, Lee said later, and his eyes. That's the first thing I remember because it was like I had known the man before, like he had known me before. It was an intriguing déjà vu experience. Stevens and the elders stayed at a guest house in Dussenen, a small village over the hill and 15 minutes from the farm, where every half hour, bells pealed from the steeples of two old churches. Because of Stevens' prior visit and continuing long-distance relationship with Mia, the man and his family accepted the elders immediately. During the day, Mia accompanied them on drives away from the farm to give them a feel for the countryside. Through early spring it arrived, the ground at the higher elevations where Mia had taken most of his photographs remained either too soft for driving or still covered with snow. At a few of the sites, they drove and walked close enough to see from a distance the openness of the terrain, the angular pitch of the hills. At night, they ate with the family at the farmhouse and listened to Mia's stories of the contacts. They had been taking place now for over 3 years. In all, Mia claimed to have met face to face with Samjays or one of the other Pleiadians over 100 times. The notes had grown to nearly 3,000 pages of conversation on interstellar travel, life on Era, universal law, advanced physics, archaeology, astronomy, creation, the fate of other human races, the destiny of planet Earth, and spiritual societies obscuring even the Pleiadians. Only 14 days earlier, Mia had had another contact. The man seemed open and honest, a fact, Brit noted in her diary, that intrigued Li. Not hiding anything, she wrote. Eyes sincere. Does not look away when answering questions, extremely direct. Kids, cute like all kids, love chocolate drinks. Calliope very quiet, haunting. I tried to focus on Mia, Elders said later. Steve had his area of expertise, Tom had his. I felt more comfortable in focusing on the man, trying to get close to him. That wasn't hard to do, really wasn't much of a challenge. I've read many books on psychology, and I watched his body language to see if it might tell something about him, see if he was defensive in answering questions, moved his arm, crossed his legs, that type of thing. I checked eye blink rate to see if it increased when I asked certain questions. But I never really detected anything of a nervous nature with him. He was very stable, very calm. Someone once remarked that the eyes are the mirror to one's soul, and if this were true, then Mia had nothing to hide because he didn't back down from you, he wasn't shifty-eyed, he didn't look at the ground, he looked you directly in the eye. Mia offered the elders albums full of photographs to peruse, told them to read whatever they pleased in the translated portions of the contact notes, and answered their questions with a tired patience. One evening, he showed them several films he had taken of the beamships with an old 8mm camera. In one of the films, a black and white segment shot on a cloudy day, a ship darts back and forth near a large pine tree. Suddenly, it cuts in front of the tree and as it does, so the upper branches sway as if in a backwash. Li Elders had Mia run the short clip over and over, watching closely for the blast as the ship seemed suddenly to swing in front of the tree. In another sequence, a ship flies into the scene at Hasenball and comes to a perfect stop. It doesn't move or swing, but hovers until it takes off again. And there are other objects in the scene, snow-capped peaks in the distance, wind blowing through the branches of a pine tree to the right. Elders and Stevens imagined helicopter and long cables, but they couldn't figure out how Mia made the ship come to a complete stop without swinging. The extremes that took place each day began to bother Li Elders. In the mornings and afternoons, he might embark on one of his inquisitive tours of the farm and surrounding forests and turn up nothing, or he would be out viewing sights from a distance, increasingly curious at how Mia was able to fake the photographs. Then at night, he would sit around the kitchen table listening to Mia's casual recollections. He sounded almost bored of being teleported into a Pleiadian beamship or of traveling to other planets. Elders could not accept most of what Mia said simply because it could not be true. But the next day, he would go back out and view another site, talk to more witnesses, and perhaps see something new, like photos of the landing tracks, and he would get to wondering how he himself would manufacture something so convincing, and his mind would go blank. Elders and Stevens took Mia's photos with them as close as they could get to the sites, and, using them for comparison and orientation, brainstormed on ways that Mia could have rigged a scene in photograph to hanging model. Or, far more complicated, how he could have set a model in motion and captured it on film. We matched them up, recalled Stevens, that the pictures had to be taken right there, that was the point where the photographer stood, and there was no way he could have rigged anything because there are no trees around, no poles, nothing there, and the ground fell away downhill, at a steep angle, and the next one was 4 miles away coming up the hill, and the objects were out in between. We thought of rigging a pole with wires running out, but we couldn't find anything we could run the wires to because the trees were all 100 feet away, and there was nothing else there. Plus, there was no way he could have run a string of wires like that alone, getting up and down poles and trees with one arm. Have you ever tried to climb a tree with one arm? We thought if there were Confederates, in 3.5 years, they would have found one because we weren't the only ones looking for Confederates, everybody there was looking for Confederates. The elders had expected to find a commune filled with brainwashed teenagers trying to sell newcomers on their righteous message from the Pleiadians and the prophet Billy Mia. But the only young people at the farm were the ones camped in tents who left after a few days of working and talking, and were replaced by new arrivals. Most of the people who came often to the farm, some to work on weekends, others to help Mia with his small publication Wassermansiet, were at least in their late 20s, many of them older than Mia himself. One was a school principal, two were school teachers, one worked as a graphic artist, and another as a computer programmer. And nobody tried to sell anything, ideas or artifacts. Originally prepared to dislike Mia, and still not trusting him, Elders nevertheless found himself enjoying the man's company. It was fun talking and listening to him, he recalled. We all had our shots of rum or coffee, and that took the edge off. I guess he was using alcohol on me as much as I wanted to use it on him, to see where I was coming from. But we'd have a couple belts and everybody'd loosen up. Mia led a fascinating life. His life reminded me so much of my years of exploration in South America. We had something in common to talk about. I was fascinated by his Middle East stories, he was fascinated by my expeditions into South America. We got along well. One evening, the elders sat in the Mia kitchen, the only place they could get warm. Dinner that night consisted of hot chunks of a heavy bread that Popeye had baked over the fireplace and a white cheese that Mia himself made from the milk of his two dairy cows kept in a stall beneath the house. Mia, in a reflective mood, sipped coffee from a white china Demeter adorned by a bright enamel rose. He told the elders that every time he had contact with the Pleiadians, he found it difficult to return to his normal life on Earth. If I go there, he said, if I talk with them, if I am in the ship together with them, I never like to return to the Earth. Every time, I have trouble coming back. You see, if I am shouting there, really shouting, pounding my fist on the table, it's something else than if I am shouting here on the Earth. I'm shouting there in peace and in love. Sometimes, I have to make myself very, very angry to come back home. It's so peaceful and restful and loving there, speaking together with them. You see what can happen, and everything in the world is okay. There, I am much more clear in my head, in my thinking and feeling, than here. Then, I have to return to a world which is full of turmoil and shouting and everything. There is fighting, day after day, hour after hour, second after second. With them, it is not so. If you are shouting there, it is with peace and love, too. The elders wanted to know the answer to a question that probably was the one most asked of Mia: why had the Pleiadians specifically selected him for the contacts? Matter-of-factly, Mia explained that he had been groomed for the contacts since he was a small boy, and before that, in a previous incarnation, he had had contacts with the Pleiadians. According to Mia, the Pleiadians' desire to reveal their presence slowly and without ceremony arose from events that occurred long ago, when early Earth humans believed that the visitors from elsewhere in the universe were gods or the angels of God. The Pleiadians distanced themselves every time from such things, he explained. There is one way around this problem. To tell the people, to tell them again, again, and again, what's really happening, what the Pleiadians are really, that they are humans like the humans from this Earth, that they are no more. What I have to do practically every day, I have to shout. I have to beat my fist on the table to tell the people what is real. And they have the same problem. But there is one way of teaching. Tell the people day after day, hour after hour, they are really not gods. But can they be accepted as people like ourselves? Asked Lee. Impossible to connect them, said Mia. It's exactly the same thing if you have a motor that works with regular gasoline, and you go and put pitch into the gasoline, it blows up. They're not like us, said Lee. They may look like us, they may talk like us. But the vibrations, interrupted Mia, the waves and everything, that's much higher. The elders, of course, had no way of testing Mia's story of what the Pleiadians looked like, how he came to be their contact, or what knowledge and information the Pleiadians, if they existed, had imparted to him. They tried to avoid dealing with such claims, which seemed too outlandish to believe, yet could not be disproved. Unless it happens to you, Bush said later, you're always going to have that little doubt anyhow, is it or isn't it real? How do you explain it, and how do you rationalize it? They wanted to see more of Mia's tangible evidence, what he could offer to establish the Palladian's presence. Without this, Mia's stories meant nothing to them.